Hello, welcome to Foreign Entanglements. I'm Matt Duss. I'm a policy analyst at the Center for American Progress and a columnist for the American Prospect. With me today is Hugh Pope. Hugh is the project director for Turkey and Cyprus at the International Crisis Group. He's the author of a number of books, most recently Dining with Al-Qaeda. Also publishes the blog hughpope.com, which I've been checking regularly for his updates on the ongoing protests in Istanbul and elsewhere in Turkey over the past week. Hugh, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So just to set it up for you, the protests, I believe, started exactly a week ago on the 27th. A small number of protesters protesting the destruction of a green space, of some loss of some trees in a small park near Taksim Square. And why don't you just go ahead and explain how they started and how they quickly developed into something much, much bigger?
The protest itself was, I think, not really particularly noticed by anyone to start with until it was attacked by police who wished to remove them. The protest was about actually a very small number of trees in the corner of a park that were being removed to make way for a pavement as part of a road building project. And there was the moment that the police attacked, they became an escalating ball of interest in terms of politicians getting involved and pictures shooting around the social media. And very soon it became clear that the protest was a vein of anger and resentment in one section of the population of Istanbul. And a lot of other things began to be wrapped into the question of those few trees in the corner of the park. First of all, there was the idea that this whole park would later, as part of this redevelopment of one of Turkey's Istanbul's central squares and one of Turkey's most famous landmarks, was going to become another shopping mall. And then people remembered that they were angry about something that had happened midway through the month, which was that the government suddenly declared that it was going to be bringing in new regulations on the sale of alcohol. Not a ban, but a new set of regulations, which initially the government said was all about having advanced countries' standards in and pointing to Scandinavia and perhaps some states in the United States. But the fact is that the Prime Minister also made in one of his many statements about this. He said, why are you paying so much attention to laws made by a couple of drunkards and not paying attention to the laws of God and what Islam says should happen? So he explicitly connected it to Islam. And that at that point, I think people felt that their lifestyles were going to be infringed. And then, by this time, I mean, by the time people got angry, by the time there'd been three nights of police interventions on Gezi Park, there was a really large body of people involved, several thousand people coming and going. And people began to remember all kinds of other things they were upset about the way the government has been working in recent months, all the huge projects that are changing the way Istanbul is. And certainly from an environmentalist perspective, some of them have huge impact. Last week, a third bridge over the Bosphorus was inaugurated, which allegedly will cost the lives of a million trees. A couple of weeks before that, there was the tender for the new airport in Istanbul, supposedly going to cost 2 million trees of a forest and be the world's biggest airport, which is something which most people in Turkey are not used to, the idea of the world's biggest.
And just to go back to the bridge quickly, a very provocatively named bridge, right?
I think that whoever chose the name of that bridge was not thinking it through.
Can you just explain that
the
audience?
Named after Sultan Selim, usually called Sultan Selim the Grim in English, that makes him sound a bit more negative than he sounds in Turkish. In Turkish, it comes across as a bit more steadfast. But still, he is a sultan in 500 years ago who not only conquered the Arab heartlands for the Turks and the Ottoman Empire, but he also is well known for having been pretty brutal towards a community known as the Alevis in Turkey, who are a heterodox, almost Shiite style of faith-based faith community that was attacked by this. And that all Alevi associations were deeply hurt by the choice of this name. It's pretty insensitive, is how one might put it.
So it seems like there's two separate things that you just said. I mean, one is the government's, you know, way of just pushing through these huge projects with very little consultation with regard to environmental groups, neighborhood groups. But there's also, so I mean, you can, whatever, there's the sort of crony capitalist aspect of that. But then on the other side, there's also the social conservatism aspect with the alcohol ban. So it's just, you know, for lack of a better term, a kind of perfect storm of just we're mad as hell and we're not going to take this anymore on the part of the protesters.
There's a car on this Taksim Square on which lots of notes have been posted by all kinds of groups, from gays, lesbians, and Alevis and Kurds and secularists and ultranationalists, and any manner of group has come forward to say, I want my voice heard too. There's no real leader of this set of demonstrations. A platform has emerged, the Taksim Solidarity Platform, and I think most people hadn't even heard of it until yesterday, when they came out with a list of demands that were quite ambitious, but still appeared to represent a lot of what was being said in slogans of the crowds, which have been a fascinating mix. There are whole websites dedicated to collecting the slogans, anything from "My country is beautiful when she gets angry," or and another one in honor of the fact that the television stations were, at least the mainstream television stations, were broadcasting very little of what was going on. Another slogan was, of course, the revolution will not be televised. And
yeah, let's stop there for a moment, because I think that's really important. The real failure of the local news stations, and even, you know, stations like CNN Turkish, to really cover nearly or at all.
Yes, the mainstream ones were nervous about doing it. There is a sense of great caution amongst the mainstream media, which are owned, most of which is owned by big conglomerates, which rely on contracts with the government to do anything that might upset the government. And there's been a pattern of people being dismissed from television stations when they were too outspoken, and this was again felt to be insulting by the demonstrators. When on one evening, instead of one of the most dramatic evenings of all these protests, when there was a lot of violence on the streets, one of the main news channels was broadcasting a documentary about penguins. But that also has been turned into a joke. People now turn up to the main square to demonstrate dressed as penguins. this is what's so interesting about what's happening, is that for the first time, I mean, I've lived in Turkey 25 years. I have never seen humor brought to politics. And it's incredibly liberating. It's not only has the secular Western middle class apparently broken through its fear barrier, but it's also somehow everyone's walking taller. People are feeling proud of the fact that they're demonstrating, and they're making fun. They're having fun, and that is so unusual. And it's really a positive energy in the streets that are not obviously not the barricades where people are fighting the police. That that's a bit different there. But one has to remember that, you know, 99.9% of Turkey is not fighting the police. You know, the streets where this was all happening a few days ago, it's almost impossible to tell that anything happened here, whereas it was a total mess afterwards. But
No. Do you what are the estimates of the crowd numbers at the height of the Istanbul protests?
Because the streets are not that wide, and people are being scattered the whole time. Definitely thousands, possibly a few tens of thousands.
Yeah. So, looking at the Prime Minister's response, which has thus far not been encouraging, although just what I've seen today, he seems to be slightly walking it back a little. I mean, his initial response was very arrogant, very dismissive, calling the protesters a bunch of drunks, and then it eventually got even worse with the government starting to accuse a familiar litany that we've seen in the region of accusing foreign interlopers of inspiring the protests. So what do you think Erdogan's response and his comments over the past week say about him, his governing style, and his own political future and the future of his party?
Prime Minister Erdogan is certainly the most effective politician Turkey's had since the founder of the Republic, Kemal Atatürk. And he's been on the top of his game for 10 years now as the ruler of Turkey. And it's that which is so surprising in what's happened, is that the Prime Minister appears to have misjudged the popular mood. And above all, in the belittling comments and making it sound as though there was nothing happening, whereas anybody who came anywhere near what was going on could see that this was a major event. And it really hardened the determination of the protesters to make their voice heard. So in that sense, it's clear that the Prime Minister got used to the idea of that, he is an amazingly legitimate figure in many ways. Who else wins 50% of the popular vote? And it was only 2 years ago that he won that in an ever-increasing pattern of every election he's been winning more. So it's not surprising that he felt as though he was empowered to do a lot of things that he wanted to do, but the incredible rush, the onrush of all these projects that were not only incredibly expensive projects, and there was this always in Turkey, there's always, even if it was completely fairly tendered and everything, there will always be suspicion that such things are benefiting friends of the family. But, even if it was completely fair, there was just a sense that, hang on, where is this all taking to us? We are not being consulted and everything is changing. A major mosque being put on top of a hilltop that can be seen from most parts of Istanbul, according to a design that was no one understands how that design was chosen. It's not that it was necessarily wrong to put a mosque there, but it was, one gets to do that once every few centuries. Why didn't we have a full debate about it?
Yeah. Interesting.
And it's the same for Taksim Square. And it's the same for the big airport. And there have been urban renewal projects as well. Some of them actually make parts of Istanbul look much nicer than before, but some of them are forcibly nationalizing whole blocks of property, and no one knows quite according to what system these properties are being reallocated. There's also a sense that the newly made things have no character, and that they're not really the old thing restored. They're some new thing that is replacing the old thing, and it's something to do with the government. And I'm not saying that what AKP is doing is qualitatively different from what previous governments have done or not done. I mean, it's the ugly development, unfortunately, has been a characteristic of many stages of this developing country's urban history. But it's the onrush of all these things. I can think of seven or eight big projects that have suddenly come down the road, and that's made people very feel very as though something is infringing upon their sense of identity, even as citizens of Istanbul.
Right. Just that sense that they are not being consulted, or even their concerns are not even being taken into account as all these new projects spring up.
Exactly.
I mean, just taking a step back, looking at the last 10 years of AKP rule in Turkey, Prime Minister Erdogan's tenure as prime minister. When he came to power, when the AKP came to power, they did so with the support of a number of these secular liberals who supported the AKP as an option, a good option against the military-dominated old order. Is that correct to say?
Yes, I think that that's one of the reasons that AKP was able to come to power so impressively, is that they appealed to the liberals who wanted to reform the country, because AKP also wanted to reform the country as part of its agenda. And it from the first 3 or 4 years of its being in power, it was a reformist party. And then around 2007, during the great standoff with the army, which is, I suppose, AKP's most significant achievement, has been to consign the Turkish army, which used to be all powerful in political matters, back to the barracks. And around that point, also the EU process of negotiations and adapting Turkish laws to the European Union norms and basically upgrading the country on a wide front basically stopped. And you can look at some of the figures of Turkey's rankings in the world, and it could be, for instance, women's role in Turkish society and government has visibly declined. I mean, it used to be 105th a few years ago. Now it's 126th, according to the World Economic Forum, for instance. And the prison population has doubled, for instance, in the last couple of years. And the prison population has doubled in the last couple of years. And there's a tangible sense that Turkey has lost reform momentum. And this is why I think that, you know, when Prime Minister looks at what he's going to do to fix this, apart from obviously empathetically reaching out to the mainstream of the opposition and persuading them that he is going to be more inclusive about these landmark issues, is why not make this a moment where he relaunches that EU negotiation process. Now, I'm not, I think it would be naive to think that Turkey is going to be able to join the EU in less than a decade or more, but that's not really the point. What people want the process for is to have a neutral, non-partisan system for modernizing the Turkish legal system, the taxation system, the judiciary, freedom of expression, all these things, these sort of second generation issues of the EU process, which Turkey never got round to doing. And by doing so, there would also be a neutral way to fix the constitution of Turkey, which is very old-fashioned and was actually drawn up under military rule in 1982. And fixing the constitution is absolutely vital for one of the most important policies that Mr. Erdogan has developed this year. To be fair to him, it started much earlier and there's been bumps along the way. But right now, at least here at Crisis Group, we think that it has an enormous chance of success because there's so many factors in its favor. And that is to solve Turkey's three-decade-old PKK insurgency, which has killed 30,000 people, cost hundreds of billions of dollars. And to fix it, you have to have a new constitution that will treat all citizens in a non-discriminatory manner and remove all ethnic discrimination and perceived ethnic discrimination. And this has got stuck because Mr. Erdogan didn't know how to do it in the face of perceived Turkish nationalist opposition. Now that there is this democratization demand from the streets of Istanbul, Ankara, Izmir, many other cities, why not repackage that constitutional change, including the ones that address the Kurdish grievances, and make it a constitution that addresses all of Turkey's grievances, which are now so clearly heard.
Yeah.
And it's you know, there are ways that this challenge could be turned into an opportunity. And it's really to be hoped that the Prime Minister will start looking at it in slightly more constructive terms than a don't try to compete with me, which is what he said at one point.
Hmm. On that question of competition, I mean, it's been interesting to watch how the Turkish President Abdullah Gül has responded, you know, in contrast to how Erdogan has responded. As Erdogan is finishing out his final term as prime minister, I think there's a lot of expectation that he will then run for president. What do you see this coming to a head between these two politicians? I mean, what is the relationship between Gül and Erdogan?
It's not just Gül and Erdogan. There's a whole group of politicians that have been together for 20 or 30 years. They've seen a really rough times. And even the most empathetic of them currently, the Deputy Prime Minister, Bülent Arınç, he pointed out, you know, we had our party closed down. We were thrown out of our jobs. And, you know, we are not doing that to you.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't accuse us of going too far. But when it comes to the competition between them, I think that people really appreciated the empathetic interventions of President Gül and Bülent Arınç, and obviously that may have altered their standing in popular opinion. But the fact is that this group of people have been together for so long, and they stand to lose so much by actually competing directly against each other that I find it very difficult to imagine that they will break ranks at this point. But, you know, there are major pro-AKP commentators who are calling on Prime Minister Erdogan to join the more empathetic strand AKP. And the implication, of course, being that if he does not, then there could be a split. But I think it's very early to say that. I mean, there's a whole electoral cycle coming. AKP is an extremely disciplined party. They've made such a success of themselves. I know that there's a lot of resentment at the Prime Minister's high-handed style, even within the Muslim conservative segment of Turkish society. But still, the AKP is still one of the most effective parties that Turkey's ever produced.
If we could, I want to get to what this means for the U.S.-Turkey partnership. But before we do, where has the Gülen movement been during these protests? And I know this is probably a tall order, but if you could just very briefly describe what I'm talking about.
I think every period of Turkish policies, every period of Turkish policy throws up a grey mastermind that is doing everything. Sometimes it's the deep state, sometimes it's America, sometimes it's Israel, and sometimes it's what you're referring to, the Fethullah Gülen movement. Elderly Turkish prayer leader from the west of the country who's currently in sort of quasi-exile in Pennsylvania.
And lives in an estate in the Poconos.
Indeed. Yes. And his organization is extraordinarily influential these days in Turkey. People debate as to whether it's a kind of contract enforcing Masonic order, whether it's a religious group, or whether it has a secret agenda to take over the government. It's not completely transparent. All I can say is that the Gülen groups that I've come into contact with over the years all seem to be basically doing good and trying to educate kids and not wishing to talk about their ultimate goals.
I think that's kind of the key concern I've noticed from Turkish friends I've spoken to about is that, you know, it's just a lack of transparency. It's a lack of being able to talk to anyone who identifies, yes, I'm part of this movement and here's what we want to achieve. That's what really kind of raises flags for a lot of people.
Or the alternative is that it really is not a very, it's more of a franchise thing, and it's something that people, a set of ideas that people take, and while being very loyal to the core of the the movement. They are actually trying to act as a pressure group rather than as a political party. And as that, you know, it's not quite fair to say that they're hidden. I mean, you know, everyone knows who the leading Gulenists are. It's a little coded, should I say, but they are present. They make their views clear, and they are sometimes with AKP and Erdogan. They're sometimes against him. And as far as I can tell, when they're with him, it's when Erdogan is doing things that are broadly positive for the country. And when they're critical of him, it's when they feel that there is, for instance, the famous incident where AKP suddenly rushed through a law that would help save the skins of some people who'd been done for match fixing in soccer, for instance. And that kind of thing was when you could see the Gulen movement putting pressure against AKP. So, you know, not, as I said, certainly it seems to be a force for good. But what a lot of Turkish people were worried about are the supposed infiltration into the police and certain state institutions. And then they start building extraordinary conspiracy theories about how this is all about a big power struggle. Now, absolutely no idea, but on the whole, I think that the Gulen movement has been making statements, and they've been trying to calm the situation down. And again, I would say that was the right thing to do. I think that was the right call to make.
So getting to getting to Turkey's sort of foreign policy, the way it's reacted to the upheavals in the region over the past couple of years, and the relationship with the United States. I mean, first on the Kurdish issue, I think there was what was generally regarded as a pretty big breakthrough a few weeks ago with Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, who's been in prison for over a decade now, who made a call essentially for the end of the PKK's armed struggle, or at least a willingness to negotiate. That how do you think that has how that impacted or what role has that played in Erdogan's behavior subsequently?
The Kurdish initiative is a really, really important part of what Erdogan is trying to do, possibly as a legacy issue, possibly to create a real achievement that will carry him through to the presidency. But for whatever reason, it's clearly a strategic choice to try and end this insurgency. And perhaps he realizes, too, that the only way to make that stick is to solve the Kurdish problem as well, or at least address Kurdish grievances satisfactorily. This is thought to be a dangerous, risky strategy, because the assumption is that there is a Turkish nationalist resistance to any concessions that would solve which would address Kurdish grievances. And at such times, some people believe that the prime minister will make positions that will reassure his core constituency of conservatives, and would therefore point to things like the alcohol regulations as red meat for that constituency. And indeed, Prime Minister Erdogan is a consummate politician. He is incredibly successful at it, and his total focus is always on retaining maximum power and building on his power while also being very pro-business. I mean, it's so
maybe I could just jump in. Like, do you see? What I was kind of getting at is are these the moves that Erdogan made, the alcohol ban? Do you see those as kind of directly resulting from the Kurdish initiative as a way to signal to his Kurdish constituency, yes, I'm still the same guy you know and love. I'm still doing this stuff. Don't worry.
That's what some Turkish commentators indeed say. But of course, this is the part of the coded side of what is being discussed. But yeah, go ahead.
So the last point I just want to talk about, the U.S.-Turkey partnership. President Obama has, you know, said at various times, you know, how much he values the relationship with Erdogan personally. It's not, I don't think it's a big secret that President Obama is not someone who has established the strongest personal relationship with a lot of world leaders. But for whatever reason, it seems that he and Erdogan have hit it off to a certain extent. And more on a policy level, the administration has made clear, abundantly clear, that they see Turkey as a very important partner on a number of fronts. What impact do you think that the negotiations and the government's response might have for the U.S.-Turkey partnership? Is it too early to say? Do we just have to wait and see? Or what are your thoughts?
Well, I think we have to look at what is this U.S.-Turkey partnership in the first place. I mean, the U.S. is a global superpower and Turkey is a middle-ranking developing country. I don't think it's really a partnership, is it? I mean, there are lots of there are a number of things which the U.S. needs from Turkey that are more important than Turkey, the Turkey relationship itself. For instance, air corridors to Afghanistan, the use of a big air base at Incirlik, radars looking at Iran, intelligence on Syria, the NATO alliance, which keeps historically has had a lot to do with Turkey's geographic proximity to Russia. And Turkey is, you know, in many places of the world, quite a good friend to have. There's no killer application, if you like, that makes Turkey absolutely vital to the United States. But the collection of things that Turkey offers is very interesting and has remained very interesting. And it makes Turkey, alongside Israel, the United States' most important partner, as you put it, in the region. But this is very much a state-to-state relationship where it's a lot to do with jets in the night bringing high intelligence or military officials to Ankara to meet people to discuss things which often no one knows what they are. It's very different, for instance, from the relationship with the European Union, for instance, which is, you know, a massive trading relationship, a huge people-to-people contact, a dense web of airline routes, and so forth. That's a, you know, and as a result, usually when it comes to internal Turkish politics, the United States is quite reluctant to get involved. For instance, there are thousands of Kurdish activists, Kurdish national movement activists, in jail right now. They've been, some of them have been there for 4 years now in jail with pending trial on terrorism charges, which would not be considered terrorism anywhere else in the world. You know, these are, you know, considered members of a terrorist group merely for things they've said and so forth. And and this kind of thing does not attract critical attention from the United States usually. But funnily enough, these latest protests did prompt a couple of statements from the U.S. and defending the right of freedom of assembly. Can't say it had a massive impact on anybody, but it was noticed that the U.S. was putting a little bit of space between itself and Mr. Erdogan. But I think that you'll notice that when push comes to shove, and this is a historical tendency, that there are so many issues of vital strategic importance in the United States' mind that the day-to-day politics of Turkey generally get only second billing.
I mean, on the jail, you know, putting people in jail issue, I think we should mention also there's a large number of journalists in jail in Turkey, which goes to what we were talking about earlier about the intimidation of the press. Again, something the United States has not really made a big enough deal about, in my view.
One thing we should remember is that, you know, 2/3 of those journalists and media workers who are in jail are in jail on Kurdish charges, on Kurdish-related charges. So, in a sense, that's more of an extension of the Kurdish group of problems than the media freedom group of problems. While you know, that obviously remains an issue.
Okay. Well, I think that about does it. Thanks so much for taking the time.